Thanks. So thanks very much. The tentative title of the talk is Towards Exact Results for BPS Black Hole Entropy in the S2 Model. So let me start with a possible motivation for this work. Suppose you look at black holes in two derivative gravity theories, then it's well known that the thermodynamic or macroscopic entropy of such black holes is given by two leading order by the Bekenstein-Hawking area law, which states that the entropy is a quarter of the area of the event horizon. But this will then this entropy will receive corrections, and the corrections may be of different types. There may be a correction term that goes with the log of the area times a certain number. You could also have power law, inverse power law corrections. So what you then have here is an entropy, a macroscopic entropy or a thermodynamic entropy, which you can view as a function of the area of the event horizon. The question is, what is the nature of this function? Could it be that it is, for instance, resurgent? So nature of S of A. Now, one possibility for trying to analyze this question is to specialize to extremal black holes. So extremal black holes form a subset of the space of black holes.
Are there terms of log A divided by some power?
I would not be able to say at this stage. This is just an indication that there are all kinds of corrections, and we'll try to understand them. We could then, to try to get a better understanding of this, we could then try to look at extremal black holes, at the subset of extremal black holes. In this context, there is a framework for computing the exact macroscopic entropy, which is called the quantum entropy function. And this is a framework or an object introduced by Ashok-Sen, quantum entropy function. In this paper, let me give you the reference, 0809.3304. Extremal here means that the black holes are charged. Let's denote the charges generically by capital Q. And this then means that the leading entropy will be proportional to the square of the area will be proportional to the square of the charge. And the quantum entropy function is then a complicated object denoted by W hat, which is defined in terms of an Euclidean patent rule, a suitable Euclidean patent rule of quantum gravity in an ADS spacetime. So Euclidean patent rule of quantum gravity in an ADS2 spacetime. Now, I'm not going to introduce this further. You can look it up in that paper. And this is, of course, a complicated object still. So therefore, you can now continue specializing and look at the subset of extremal black holes, which are supersymmetric. So that now means that you will now turn to supersymmetric supergravity theories, look at BPS black holes, and see if you get a handle on this object. And that's the specialization I'm going to take in this talk, BPS black holes as a subset of extremal black holes. Now, I'm going to do this in the context of n equals to 2 in four dimensions. So I'll be focusing on BPS black holes in n equals to 2 supergravity theories in four dimensions. And in this context, it has been shown by Dobolkar, Murthy, and Gomes that this complicated that this quantum entropy function from which you, which if you were to be able to calculate it exactly, would give you the exact macroscopic entropy of the black hole as a function of the charges, and charges the same as area. So in the n equals to 2 context, it has been shown by Gomes, Dabokar, and Murthy that this path integral localizes onto a finite dimensional, to a finite dimensional integral, which is still complicated. And this has been done by localization means, methods. And this you can read up in the paper. So this is the Dabokar. I never know where the H is. Never know if it's there or there. The Dabokar, Gomes, and Murthy. Is it not right? Okay, thank you. Murthy in the paper 10120265. So as I was saying, they have argued that by localization techniques, one can actually reduce this complicated path integral to an integral over a finite dimensional set of fields, which is then roughly given by the following object. So you will have a set of fields here, scalar fields psi, indexed by an index I. You are then instructed to look at this integral, exponential of pi, and now there is a holomorphic function f appearing in here, which will be the subject of this talk, which is evaluated on these scalar fields shifted by a magnetic charge carried by the black hole, minus electric charge times phi. So you're instructed to do this sort of a path integral. There is a suitable measure here, which I will not have to say, which I will not comment about. So you're instructed to do an integral of this sort, and that will then give you the exact macroscopic entropy for these BPS black holes.
When you're talking about entropy, it implies that it is kind of some statistical feature, right? So in this way, it's not like a completely quantum object. So let's say, for example, it is implies certain, say, the zero temperature or...
These are zero temperature black holes. I should have mentioned that. Yes. Yes.
Right. But in this way, this definition, how it reflects this kind of statistical nature of the object? Because if it would be just normal quantum system, right, BPS system would be, you know, some number of states, that's it, right?
Right. So what I have defined here is the macroscopic entropy for a BPS black hole. Once you have computed that, you can ask yourself whether you can reproduce that through state counting of microstates carrying the same charge Q. And that is then yet a different story, which you can do in parallel. And if you manage to come up with a microstate counting formula which precisely reproduces that thing, then you will have said that you have understood, or that you have at least counted the microstates of the black hole. But that is a different avenue. And I will not have anything to say about that avenue, but as a matter of fact, that serves as a further motivation for this work, which is to actually try to compute this macroscopic entropy to a certain accuracy for BPS black holes in n equals to 2, and then try to see whether for the black holes in the particular model we are going to look at, whether we can actually do a state counting that will reproduce that macroscopic entropy. Since nothing is known, or very little is known about state counting, about the state counting of microstates for n equals to 2 black holes, this is a non-trivial question. Now, as I said, this is a complicated object. There are measure factors and other complications in here. But suppose now that you want to evaluate this in a semi-classical approximation by evaluating this path integral on the leading saddle point. then what you get is you get the semi-classical entropy, which is called Wald entropy, and it is then given by the exponent here evaluated on the saddle. So you are then instructed to extremize this, and that will give you a first approximation to the macroscopic entropy of the object. So the thing to notice is that this object, the semi-classical Wald entropy, as well as the full entropy, the full macroscopic entropy, they are determined in terms of this holomorphic function f. So in the given n equals to 2 model, in order to have an accurate, in order to be able to evaluate this accurately, what you then therefore need to have is control over the holomorphic function f. And this is what I will be focusing on next.
Is it a unique saddle point, or are
there multiple saddle points? There are multiple saddle points. Let's assume that there is a leading saddle point on which you evaluate that, and that will give you the semi-classically corrected entropy. It will give you the leading term plus corrections.
Can you interpret the leading saddle points in terms of extra geometries? Is it the same asymptotics or something like that? Or you're not interested in those?
Well, eventually, for the purpose of this talk, I will not have anything to say about that. But Shoke and collaborators have looked at these objects in the context of n equals to 4, and Dobokar and Murthy also in the context of n equals to 8. And they have indeed given the subleading saddles a geometric interpretation in terms of certain orbifolds. Now, so the thing then to notice is that we need this object, this function f, this holomorphic function as an input in these calculations in order to do a precision calculation here to eventually try to address the initial question I asked there. Now, let us then look at this holomorphic function in n equals to 2 models in a little bit more detail, and this is now work, and here I should mention that the work I'm going to describe now is done in collaboration with Svapna Mahapatra and Bernard de Witt. And so let's review some of the relevant features of n equals to 2 for the purpose of black holes. So let's look at the Wilsonian, at what is called the Wilsonian low energy effective action. And let's look at the part of it which is relevant for the BPS black holes, which is the part that is encoded in a holomorphic function f. F is an object that depends on two types of fields. It depends on, it's a holomorphic object, so it will depend on complex fields, xi, so it will depend on fields that I call xi and on fields that I call, and on the field that I call a hat. Xi are complex scalar fields, and they are scalar fields, and they provide local coordinates for a manifold, which in geometric language is called an affine special Kähler manifold. So these xi, these complex xi's, are local coordinates for an affine special Kähler manifold. And the field a hat is a gravitational field. Okay. Now,
is this integral already the localized path integral, or is this the thing that you localize?
This is the path into this is the localized version of this path into goal. So it got localized on a finite dimensional.
Okay, so there's a finite dimensional integral. Now.
That's right.
And the number of dimensions is the number of phi I fields. Is that,
that is right. That is right. So this index I is the same as that one over there.
Okay.
Yes.
And then how does A hat enter this integral? Where does A hat enter?
Yes. F here depends on A hat as well. And I'll come to that
good.
In a second.
Does one have to path integrate over A hat as well?
No, A hat is set to a fixed value in this integral.
Like a source or something, like a background field?
Yeah, right, precisely, yes. Yes. Yeah. So let me be a bit more precise about this function F here. Let me review some of the ingredients which we'll need.
But it implies in kind of larger version it was integral over A, right, originally, and then it is like another set of points.
No, well, no. So A hat is a gravitational field
yeah.
that in this space-time, ADS2 times S2,
yeah.
acquires a fixed value.
Ah.
So it is as if you have introduced a parameter, but at fixed value. Okay.
In a certain way, you can view ADS as a set of points for something.
So, oh, is it this way? Yes. So, let me now review a few features of this function f, coming back there to a question. This function f will be split into two pieces. F0, usually called the prepotential, and an additional piece that carries the information about the A hat. What does this mean? F0 is the prepotential. Well, it's called the prepotential, and it's the object from which you calculate the metric on this affine special Kähler manifold. So the metric of the affine special Kähler manifold, denoted usually by Nij, is then given in terms of 2 times the imaginary part of the second derivative of the prepotential with respect to the scalar fields xi, xj, as usual. So this is then, this gives rise to that. And this guy there, what does that mean? So this means the following. Imagine that you decide to switch off omega. In that case, f is equals to f0, and the superrelativity model you have is simply Einstein gravity with a nonlinear sigma model coupled to it, plus dx square. Let me denote it like that. But the minute you have omega turned on, then your Einstein action, your supergravity Einstein action gets modified and it starts including higher derivative terms of the form vau square. So turning on omega means that you're turning on higher derivative terms. They will then distort the space-time geometry of the black hole. They will affect the entropy of the black hole and will produce subleading corrections to the area law of Bekenstein and Hawking. What else do you need to know? This function f needs to be homogeneous of degree 2. So under simultaneous rescalings of x and a hat, with lambda belonging to c star, f is supposed to be homogeneous of degree 2. And so now let's look at a particular model, which is a so-called STU model, but here I should tell you that it's not the STU model which has been discussed a lot in the literature, especially in the context of heterotic type 2 duality. So it's not the STU model of Kashu and Waffe, but rather the STU model of Sennenwaffe. And some of the features of this model are the following ones. It's a model based on, well, now I have to use a little bit of supergravity terminology. It's a model based on three vector multiplets and four hypers. The Euler number, given by the difference of these quantities, n vector minus nh plus 1, is therefore 0. This means that the moduli space, the moduli space of the vectors and of the hypers does not receive quantum corrections. So we have an exact moduli space. And very importantly for this talk, we have an exact duality symmetry. And so what we'll be using is, we'll be using this exact duality symmetry, or this invariance, the invariance of this model under a certain symmetry transformations, to determine this function omega. So this translates into the following. Three vector multiplets means that we will have four such complex coordinates. We can introduce projective coordinates called STU in the usual fashion. Then the moduli space is metric doesn't receive quantum corrections. That means that the prepotential is exact and given by this cubic expression. And now let's look at omega, which encodes the gravitational coupling functions associated with higher derivative terms. And now let's do a Wilsonian expansion of this, which will have a little twist. So omega has to be homogeneous of degree 2 under scalings of x and a. Which I hat here. So let's put an a hat out in front. And then maybe I should pass this formula to the next, to over here, because that will now play an important role. So what I will do is I'll put it up there. So let me put this formula up here. So omega of x a hat will consist of an infinite set of coupling functions, starting with the first one. Then I should have introduced an expansion parameter, by the way. So let me introduce an expansion parameter and asymptotic expansion parameter. Lambda equals to a hat divided by x0. Ah, this lambda is not that lambda. I see. That's very unfortunate. I see. Let me call this, well, expansion parameter. Given by a hat divided by x0 square. So this has weight 0 under scalings. And so the Wilsonian action is then organized as a series expansion of this parameter. this parameter is taken to be small, which means that x0 is taken to be large, and that's the supergravity limit. So you then have an expansion here in terms of powers of a hat times x0 square raised to the power n times higher order gravitational coupling functions that depend on STU. So this is what you would write down in Wilsonian expansion, with this as an expansion parameter. But to this we will now add a term that is not Wilsonian, gamma logarithm of x0 square divided by a hat. So we'll add this term here, which is strictly not Wilsonian, but which will be needed in order to ensure that these gravitational coupling functions, that this omega possesses the S-duality symmetries the model is supposed to have. So gamma here will be assumed to be non-vanishing. This will be the term that will drive the story. And as I said, this term here is needed to impose or to ensure that we can implement the duality symmetries in this model, to ensure a duality symmetry. And this here is the formula that I will need in the following, so I'll put in the bracket and I hope I will not erase it. So now, what is the duality symmetry? The duality symmetry in this model is given by three copies of gamma 0,2. Gamma 0,2 is a subgroup of SL2Z. There will be three copies of this, one associated with the dilaton, with the S field, one with the T field, one with the U field. One with T, one with U. And in addition, at each order in string perturbation theory, the model is expected to have triality symmetry, which means that these coupling functions should be invariant under permutation of S, T, and U, so we'll impose triality. And this will turn out to be a heavy constraint on these gravitational coupling functions, and we'll be able to determine these gravitational coupling functions. So now, how does this work? And therefore, having determined these gravitational coupling functions that will have, by doing this, we'll have determined the low energy effective action, the Wilsonian low energy effective action, enshrined or captured by this omega here. As a series expansion in that parameter a hat divided by x0 square.
At least part of the omega from the topological string?
I'll come to that. That will be the second part of the story. In the second part of the story, I'll be going over from this Wilsonian low energy effective action to the topological string side. There I will be accessing the holomorphic anomaly equation, which will give us additional information on the completion of this, but that comes next. So, this subgroup of SL2Z is characterized by the following. So, take an element of SL2Z. The determinant, well, this has determinant 1. The entries are integer valued, and this subgroup is then obtained by restricting C to even integers. And now you want to impose that this is a symmetry here. How do you do that? You introduce the symplectic vectors that you introduce a symplectic vector in the usual manner that comprises the homogeneous the scalar fields xi and the relatives of the full function f with respect to I. Now this fi is the derivative of the full function f with respect to xi. So f was a prepotential plus omega. So this will depend on x and on a. Now, if you subject this to a symplectic transformation, then this rotates, and you get a new vector, prime. And now, you say that you have a symmetry, or rather, the transformation, the symplectic transformation, will be a symmetry of your system if the rotated entry, Fi, is obtained from the original one by shifting x by x prime. So this implements the condition that you have a symmetry of your system, in your system. So therefore, you now take transformations in gamma 0, and you analyze, you impose this symmetry constraint, and you analyze what this means for the FIs. And what you find is the following. So let's look at the gamma 0 2 subgroup of SL2Z that acts like S-duality, that acts in the usual way on the modulus S that implements S-duality. So this will mean that S will go into AS minus AB, ICS plus D, X0. Remember that we had four Xs. We can trade these four Xs for x0 and for the projective coordinates stu. If we restrict to s duality, s transforms in this fashion, x0 will transform. Sorry, this is x0 will transform. And now naively you would think that t and u are inert, but that is not the case. You see, under symplectic transformations, the x's and the f's mingle. They are rotated into one another. F, however, depends on omega. So whenever omega is non-vanishing, this mingling here of the x's and the fi's will imply that the t and the u modulus are not any longer invariant under s-duality. There will be little pollutions given by the following. So you find that T is not any longer inert. It transforms into, well, let me call this combination here delta, just to abbreviate. So it will be something like delta x0 square, and then here you have d omega du. So in the presence of omega, the T modulus is not inert anymore, and likewise for u. So these are the transformation laws of the axis under gamma 0, 2 associated with the dilaton. And now the interesting thing is what happens to the FIs. So if you work it out, you find the following. So remember that F is F0 plus 2i omega. So Fi brings in the derivatives of omega with respect to the Xi. So if you work it out, you find the following. You find that d omega dt under S-duality stays invariant. and likewise d omega du. However, d omega ds and d, and however, the remaining ones, well, the remaining ones go as follows. D omega ds, so I should say that here I'm now looking at omega as a function of x0 st u, so I'm taking derivatives of omega with respect to x0 st and u. This one here transforms, you would think, as a modular form of degree 2. Let me put it like that. But there is more on the side. There are two more terms here, and one of them is nonlinear. So there is IC minus delta. Delta, as I said, is the abbreviation of IC S plus D. X0 D omega DX0 minus, that's the first term, and then there's a second term here that goes with d omega dt, d omega du. So d omega ds, its transformation law becomes has become nonlinear. Nonlinear in omegas, in derivatives of omega. And finally, there's the last derivative, which is that this here, and the rest duality transforms into itself plus a little shift. I see delta x0 square. And then again, there's a nonlinear term here. And now I should be careful not to erase this here. There is a nonlinear term here, given by that. So these are then the transformation equations which you have to solve, and that are imposed upon you by demanding S-duality. There will be similar equations by demanding T-duality and U-duality. And, well, you now take your Wilsonian expression, you stuff it in here. You organize the left and the right-hand side in powers of this expansion parameter a hat, and you compare. So you work at a given order of a hat, you compare both sides. The left-hand side gives you then how a certain gravitational coupling transforms, and the right-hand side tells you into what it transforms. So you now solve these equations iteratively. Iteratively, by comparing terms of the same power of A. And so let me just give you one small example and then a bunch of results. So for instance, let's look at terms of first order in a hat. Then the relevant coupling is omega 1. Let's look at this transformation law here. You get omega, the transformed omega 1. Minus the omega 1 times delta square. Times delta square on that side. This term starts with a hat square, so this does not contribute to that order, and here you get the contribution because of the presence of the log term. So this here will then produce a correction of the sort minus 2i gamma delta. Right. And you find that the So that's that equation. These first equations tell you that the t derivative is invariant. And similarly for the derivative with respect to u. And now you can solve this. So, from these equations, you then infer that the first gravitational coupling function is given by the following expression. Remember that you also want to impose triality symmetry. So the first gravitational coupling function will be given by a sum of three terms. Each term goes with the function omega of s plus omega of t plus omega of u. That is manifestly triality invariant, the same function. And omega cannot be invariant under SL to Z. It will have to be a function that transforms in this fashion here under S duality. So the first gravitational coupling function is then, as I said, given by a sum of three functions where this function here transforms in this manner under S duality. And now you take that result for omega 1, you stuff it in here, and that will then affect the coupling function one order up, namely omega 2, and you keep working it out. So now let me give you a few of the results we found. And then after that, let me go over to the topological string side. So you keep doing this. And you find the following. If you now look at omega 2,
this thing still is still ambiguity for the omega itself. For example, if you add the function which has the same value as x prime and s, for example, then the equation is preserved.
That is right. I'll come to these sorts of ambiguities in just a second.
Okay, I see.
Well, right. I did not tell you what omega of s is, so that ambiguity can be absorbed by shifting omega.
Right.
I did not tell you what it is. All I require at the moment is a function that transforms in this manner. Now, if you now calculate what omega 2 is, you find this expression, 1 over gamma, d omega, this omega, with respect to s, omega, this omega, with respect to t, this omega, with respect to u. So this here we have imposed triality invariance. And this result shows that you cannot have gamma equals to 0. So for this construction to work, it's important to have added this term in the Wilsonian, this term in omega, with a non-vanishing coefficient gamma. And it goes like that. So if you now do this for omega 3, you grind it through, you discover, just to give you a further result, and then I'll comment on that ambiguity.
Gamma is 0, then the whole of capital omega vanishes. Is that the
point? When gamma is 0, then the claim would be that I cannot maintain the duality symmetries.
Unless you set the whole thing to 0.
Unless I set it to 0. And therefore, if I decide to set gamma to 0 and still maintain duality symmetries, I will have to do something else, and the something else amounts to usually adding non-holomorphic corrections. So here the goal was to deform omega in such a way that the holomorphicity of omega is preserved, but that I can impose S, T, and U duality and triality. And so if you continue omega 3, just to give you a flavor of what you find an expression of the sort after imposing triality, d omega ds, d omega dt, d omega du, the whole thing squared, plus, well, for the completeness of it, let me give you a few more terms, plus this one, and then there will be second derivatives, d omega dt, d omega du, squared, and it has to be triality symmetric, so plus terms which you get by interchanging S with T and with U. And you can go on like that. So by proceeding in this way, you can in principle construct the entire tower of gravitational coupling functions omega n to an arbitrary high order. But of course, this is not very, how shall I say, efficient. And second, there is the issue of the ambiguity, which is as follows. So imagine that you have determined a coupling function at order n that satisfies these transformation laws. Now to this, you can always add something that transforms covariantly and has the same weight as omega n. So I can add to this object a function, a product of functions, where these INs are functions that transform covariantly with the same, well, with the appropriate weight. So this here is then a function that under S duality transforms with weight 2n. And I can say add such an arbitrary thing without affecting the result I got at order omega n. But if I do that, and then I go to the, well, I should first tell you what this is, where these covariant functions are built as follows. You start from I2, which is this function here, plus, let me now erase maybe this equation. You start with this function here. You can check that under this transformation here, that this transforms covariantly with weight any with weight 2. You then construct higher ones by acting with the Sarah derivative on these lower ones. So this is then 2, and this is the Sarah derivative. This is then the Sarah derivative. And I don't remember the precise factor. So n divided by gamma d omega ds acting on in. So you can construct these towers. You can add them at every order. There is one ambiguity for you. But then if you go to the next order, since whatever you add here will start polluting the right-hand side, it will affect the result at next order. And imposing triality at next order then allows you to fix these alpha, these coefficients alpha which you have added here. And as a matter of fact, when determining these gravitational coupling functions and when ensuring that they are triality invariant, we had to add such ambiguities, which then got fixed at higher order in such a way that the higher order coupling functions were triality symmetric. But as I said, this is not a very...
If you had set alpha equal to zero, then there will be some inconsistency at higher order.
Then you will not be able to preserve triality symmetry at higher order. So you really need to add objects of this type at certain orders to be able to maintain triality symmetry at higher orders, yes. But that's not a very efficient way of doing the calculation. So now let me go over to the topological string side. But coming back to a question which you asked, so then let me just summarize this bit. of the talk. So we added a non, we added a gamma log x zero term to what we, what one usually calls the Wilsonian omega, with gamma different from zero. So this is a holomorphic deformation of the Wilsonian omega. We saw that this enables us to construct a tower of gravitational coupling functions with the required gamma 0-2 symmetry and invariant in a triality. There was a question as to what fixes omega. Omega here determines the first gravitational coupling function of the model. This first gravitational coupling function was actually computed a while ago by Kunas, by Kunas, Gregory, and Petropoulos, and they found that omega s, let me give you the reference. This is 99.990117, and they found that omega 1, omega s, was proportional to the log of this, of a Jacobi function, of a Jacobi theta function, with a certain coefficient. And if you now check how this transforms in the rest duality, it transforms in this fashion with a coefficient gamma given by minus 1 divided by 256 pi. Okay. And finally, before going over to the topological string side, so now the claim is, here we have determined the low energy effective action with the additional log term with this fixed coefficient. Now let's go back to the entropy consideration. I had told you that there is an that the semi-classical walled entropy can be computed by taking this function f. Writing, decomposing x into a real part and an imaginary part, where the imaginary part is given by the magnetic charge of the black hole, and evaluating this on the saddle, well, on the extremum. Now this function f is the function I just, this function f is the sum of the prepotential plus the omega piece which I just discussed. This piece contains the log term. If you go through the calculation, then you discover that this log term produces a correction to the area law of Bekenstein and Hawking, which goes with the log of the area times the 2 in units of 1 over 12. And this is in precise agreement. This is in precise agreement with the calculation done by Ashok Sen, where Ashok computed logarithmic area corrections to the entropy of various types of black holes in various types of models. And what he found was that that if you do this for BPS black holes in n equals to 2, d equals 4, his calculation was based on the quantum entropy function, that you find a correction to the entropy, which goes with 2 minus the Euler number divided by 12 log a. Since for us the Euler number is zero, this precisely reproduces the correction predicted by Ashok. So all of this to say that by deforming the Wilsonian action by a holomorphic log X0 term, not only have we succeeded in ensuring that the coupling functions are compatible with STU duality, but we also see that this log X0 term affects the entropy in precisely the way it's supposed that this log term precisely reproduces the log area correction predicted by a shock.
Comment on how this image is imparted, because normally if you have supersymmetric prepotential, it would be like derivative square, you know, in potential, whatever, right? So imaginary part is special, right? So the imaginary part, it is kind of because of gravity, how it comes out. I mean, compared with the global supersymmetry. Because usually you see the potential doesn't go, usually doesn't enter by itself, right? It enters through into potential through, I mean, for example, derivative, right? An imaginary part, it is not accidental, right?
Let me try to answer that question by now going over to topological string theory and introducing the Hesse potential. So let me try to answer the question in this way.
But just before that, the omega n's, they all grow mildly, or not?
Right. So right now I have not said anything about convergence yet, about convergence of this expansion. Is this asymptotic? Is it convergent in some corner of moduli space? What is it? Let me postpone that question until the very end after having gone through the topological string considerations. Why? I told you that this way of determining the coupling constants is very laborious and not very efficient, and there are these issues of ambiguities which you have to keep fixing. By mapping things over topological string side, we'll get a partial handle on that, and then let me try to come back and then raise a question at the very end. Now to your question. So now I'm going to introduce the notion of the Hesse potential introduced by Dan Fried a while ago. So now let's go over from the low energy effective action, I should say Wilsonian low energy effective action, to what one would call the topological string. And this will amount to the following. This low energy effective action was specified in terms of this holomorphic function. And in doing this map, I will now be going over to the Hesse potential, which is a symplectic function. And so I'm going to answer your question by means of symplecticity. This Hesse potential is like Hamiltonian. The measure part of the F is like a Lagrangian, evaluated in a certain background. But this Hesse potential will depend on different coordinates, which I'm going to call curly y, and it will be non-holomorphic. So therefore, this passage requires two things: a change of variables from supergravity scalar fields to new coordinates, let me call them topological string coordinates for the lack of a better name, and a Legendre transform. That brings me from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian description. Pardon me?
And the topological string usually also has only V model holomorphic quantities. So this is not an A model type of thing, as you're thinking.
This has a potential will encode the sum of the non-holomorphically corrected free energies on the topological string side.
In terms of A or B
model, what is it? Well, I'd say it's these are the free energies that are captured by the holomorphic anomaly equation. I'm not committing myself to any model here. I'm just going to do a Legendre transform. Right? I'm just doing a Legendre transform. So, A, These coordinates are introduced as follows. Let's introduce a symplectic vector with components fi chi I. This will be the real part of the symplectic vector I had on the supergravity sign. Remember that this fi here was the derivative of the full function f with respect to the xi's. And now I will introduce new coordinates in this fashion. In this fashion here, I'll introduce a different symplectic vector, now based on coordinates yi, and here I will be only using the prepotential. So this guy here, this fi0, will be the derivative of the prepotential, but now expressed in terms of the new coordinates with respect to the yi's. That's going to be the map. Now, what is the difference between that one and that one? This guy depends on omega, this guy does not depend on omega. So if I'm at the two derivative level and I switch off omega, then these two coordinates are the same, but in the presence of the omega, they are not. So that the real part of x is the same, but the imaginary part will differ. So the imaginary part of these coordinates will differ by corrections, which you can calculate in a series expansion. And I'm going to denote it like that. Now coming back to your question, do I need this? No, this I will not need. So now the Hesse potential is going to be a symplectic function of these canonical coordinates. And this is Dan Fried in the 90s. It's given by the Legendre of f of x of a with respect. So you're going to replace the imaginary part of xi by chi I. And there may be a normalization factor, which I may have missed. So the statement is that this is a Hamiltonian, a symplectic function. This is like a Lagrangian evaluated in that ADS2 background. It comes out to be imaginary part of f. And this is the Legendre transform that takes you from a Lagrangian to Hamiltonian. Now this object, you would like to evaluate it in the new coordinates. Since the new coordinates are related to the old ones by a complicated expansion, by the time you do this, you find that this symplectic function ends up being an infinite sum over symplectic functions, labeled by an n here, but now expressed in terms of the new coordinates. And for the purpose of this talk, and in view of the time, I will now pick the first one here. And the claim is that this here calculates what you would call the topological free energy, non-holomorphically corrected. So let me focus on that one. And this object turns out to be the real part of a function h, where h starts, where h is a function that depends on two ingredients. It depends holomorphically on omega, and it depends on the inverse metric of the special Kähler manifold. So it's an object that is holomorphic in omega, but the special Kähler metric is non-holomorphic, so there is non-holomorphicity encoded in Nij, and if you work it out, it starts with omega, and then there is an infinite series of correction terms here, which bring in the non-holomorphicity through the Nij's. And when I write this down here, remember I'm now in curly y coordinates, so this is really the omega in terms of the curly y coordinates, and so forth. So this guy, for instance, is d omega of y, d yi. and so forth.
Why is there no parameter in that sum for the hazard potential?
You mean an A hat? The A hat is
the previous one. So it's H n, but there's no like expansion parameter, right?
Right. So I did not tell you what this means. This here, this notation means that the first term, take an Hn, H superscript n. This means that the first term goes like n powers of omega. But since each of them is a symplectic function, and since omega by itself is not a symplectic function, this gets corrected by an infinite number of terms. So, for instance, for H1 will start with omega. Omega by itself is not a symplectic function. There will be an infinite number of correction terms in such a way that this becomes a symplectic function. Okay?
That's fine, but there's still no ordering in the sum, right? How do I know how to order the sum?
Well, the ordering is right. So when I wrote that here, it's an ordering in terms of powers of omega and derivatives of omega. So I use this information about the derivatives of omega to construct these hierarchies of HM. It's a complicated story, but it can be done. So these should be derivatives, and it's organizing derivatives of omega.
So H0 starts with no omega.
H0 has no omega.
H1 has omega, it starts with derivative of omega.
H1, you mean? H1 starts with omega. H2 will have a starting term with omega square, but it comes with the derivative, so it will be d omega d omega. And so it goes. Okay? And you can read it up in our paper. So by the way, this is Dan Fried, 97.12.042, and this is our paper. This is our paper. Something went a little. Our paper 1406.5478. But now you can do more. So now take this H, it will satisfy, it's non holomorphic because these Nijs, the inverse Cayley matrix, non holomorphic. And so it satisfies a holomorphic anomaly equation given by the following. So, this H is holomorphic in omega. The non-holomorphicity is entirely in Nij. And what you can then show is that that this non-holomorphicity is governed by this differential equation. Jk, 0, Nj, M, N, K, N times dmh dnh, and here the derivatives are, so when I write dmh, I mean dh with respect to the holomorphic coordinates curly wire. So whenever h is holomorphic, sorry, whenever the dependence on, whenever omega is holomorphic, the associated h satisfies this type of differential equation. And now let's go back to the STU model. Then that equation becomes the following.
What type of equations do capital H2 and on satisfy?
These guys? We don't know. So these are somehow derived quantities which we don't really know what kind of information they contain. The statement is that the H1 is the one that talks to the usual holomorphic anomaly equation. And so for the STU model, you find the following. So, as I said, H1 is H plus H bar. Remember that omega contained this logarithmic term. Remember that H starts with omega. So let me extract this logarithmic term, which is there in H, pull it out. So rather than writing H1 as H plus H bar, let me pull that term out. So let me pull that term out and denote the rest now H plus H bar. And then you find that this H, if you plug this expression into that non-homomorphic equation, you find that H satisfies this non-holomorphic equation. Let me introduce G top square here. S plus S bar. And there is a non-holomorphic derivative here with respect to T and to U. And here I've introduced...
You are redefining your H and H bar, is that the part? The small h? By pulling out this log?
Yeah, so I have decided to pull out the log from the original definition. So H was this expression starting with capital omega plus corrections. Omega contains a log term. I decided to pull it out, and I now call everything else H.
And then that equation will get changed.
And that
equation will now get changed.
That equation gets a little bit affected, and the result is that you get this differential equation. Now, I introduce g-top. g-top is simply this ratio here, a hat divided by y0 squared. That was the expansion parameter which we also had on the supergravity side. And finally, this derivative here is the mass derivative. So this is a non-holomorphic derivative. So psi I have, yeah. So this is the mass derivative. And now we would like to solve this equation. And there will be a similar equation for the, there will be a similar equation for T bar and U bar under triality. So, and similarly for T bar and U bar. And now we would like to solve this equation. Now, here we'll invoke an insight by Yao, Alim, and Zhu, which consists of the following. So, solve for H. And here we first follow an insight by Yao, by Alim, Yao, and Zhu. In 1506.01375, which consists in switching off the Wilsonian input. So switch off these gravitational coupling functions. This means that in omega, you only retain that term. This means that in this expression, you retain contributions coming from the log x0 term. In other words, switching off little omega, the gravitational coupling function, the Wilsonian input, does not mean that your H has become trivial. What it means is that H, if you do this, so switch off the gravitational coupling functions, then your function H becomes a function of an effective coupling only, lambda tilde, and I'm going to denote this function by H0, this effective coupling is given by G top square divided by, well, you are retaining the non-holomorphic pieces in this expansion. It's given by this, S plus S bar, T plus T bar, U plus U bar. And so the important thing to notice is that this anomaly equation here was an anomaly equation in the variables S, T, and U, not in the variable Y0. In this limit here, this PDE becomes an ODE for an effective coupling function that involves Y0. And this you can solve exactly. So you now get, the anomaly equation becomes an ODE in lambda tilde, and the ODE you get is the following. You find this equation, it's a quadratic equation. Lambda tilde minus 4 gamma square times, I ran out of space here, times lambda tilde dH0 d lambda tilde. So this is a square, this is a term linear, plus 4 gamma square equals to 0, so you find that quadratic equation, which you can solve to arrive at this equation. So you take the square root of that equation, and you get two branches. One minus plus square root of one minus 16 gamma lambda tilde. Lambda tilde is that effective coupling. And now you solve this by introducing a new variable. You make a change of variables. Let me call this V. Here you pick a branch of the square root. Let's pick the principal branch. So, rather than working on the lambda tilde plane, we now work on the V plane. Lambda tilde equals zero in this principal branch corresponds to V equals one. So working at small G top, meaning working at small lambda tilde, means that you're working in the vicinity of this point. So that would be the perturbative region of the topological string. This is one. And you can solve this exactly, and you find that H0 as a function of V is given by 2 gamma logarithm of V plus 1 halves minus, and here you adjust an integration constant, V minus 1 divided by V plus 1, such that at V equals 1, meaning zero G top, this vanishes. And therefore you now have an exact result which goes beyond the usual perturbative region limit, which exhibits a branch cut at end of pole, a branch cut starting at minus one, end of pole superimposed with a pole at minus one. So this is what you get when you have switched off the gravitational coupling functions, omega, but now you have to put them back in. And once you put them back in, everything gets distorted in the following manner. So now, in the final step, you put the gravitational coupling functions back in. So put them back in. What happens? Your function h, well, this term I pulled it out. Your function h will contain an omega 1. It will contain the h0, which we just determined. But then, of course, it will contain a further function h1 that will incorporate the higher couplings. And this function h1 will depend on lambda tilde and on st and u. But the dependence cannot be arbitrary. This here has to be a duality invariant function. And it has to be, maybe I should not have written it like that, sorry. Let me write it like that. So this h1 is a function that will depend on lambda tilde and on the coupling functions omega. It has to be duality invariant, and so it has to be duality invariant, and it has to vanish when you switch off the coupling functions. So therefore, it's natural to organize this H, it's therefore natural to view H1 as a function of objects that have this property. So let me introduce duality invariant quantities that have the property that when W is set to zero, they vanish. I'm going to denote them by I tilde n of say S, and similarly for T and U. They are going to be constructed of the covariant expressions I had introduced earlier on, divided by suitable powers of the non-homomorphic covariant derivative with respect to omega in such a way that this has weight zero under S duality. And since these guys vanish when you switch off omega, this will respect both. And now what you do is you organize your H1. This is the thing you have to now determine in order to have the full topological free energy. This guy we determined. This guy is just there. It was given to us by the Greeks. This is the one we have to determine. And this one you now organize well. We pass from lambda tilde to V. That is a convenient variable. So lambda tilde is tantamount to V. And we view this as a function of these functions ions. And organize this. So we view H1 as a function of V and of these objects, and we organize this in a series expansion in powers of these objects, and there can be a bunch of such functions, duality invariant functions, all depending on S, times functions that depend on T, times functions that depend on U, multiple products of such functions. So you expand H1 in terms of these building blocks multiplied by functions that depend on V. And now you take this monster and you stuff it back into your anomaly equation. You organize it in sectors, organized in these packages. You compare left and right. And what you find are either differential equations for these coupling functions or sometimes recursive relations for them. And you work them out very laboriously. So let me then finish with by looking at just one sector in this sum, and then trying to come back to the question about the convergence which was asked earlier on. So for instance, look at the first sector where you just have one power, one such term. So let's look at the sector, at the first sector where you just have one such object. And by triality, you then also have these ones. This is a sector starting with n equals to 2. Take this, plug it into the anomaly equation to determine the Cn's, and what you find is, you find an algebraic equation for the Cn's, which is solved by the following. The Cn's of these are going to be a certain power divided by n factorial times v minus 1, v plus 1 to the power n. Now, this is just one result associated with the first sector. You have an infinite number of sectors here to analyze. But now let me come back to the question about the convergence of this expansion. And then I'll finish.
Sorry, just before that, so this is singularity of v equals minus 1. Does it cancel the other one you have?
What did you say? Equals minus 1? Sorry, what was it? V.
Minus 1, you had a branch cut before, right?
We had the branch cut in the contained in the H0.
Right. Does the branch cut of H1 cancel the branch cut of H0?
I don't think so. Let me continue. So you may now ask, okay, now that we have determined the Cn's, let's put them back into here. And let's see what this means. So now remember that you have H1, which had a log term of y0 squared divided by a hat plus h bar. H is given by this complicated object here. And in here, we are now looking at one sector given by that. Now recall also that I told you how to go back to the low energy effective action. You take this expression, you switch off the non-homomorphic dependence. So if you do this in this expression, so therefore if you now do this in this particular term, then switching off the non-homomorphic corrections contained in here produce an expression of this sort. So this stays. And this here becomes IN of S. Times dt of omega du of omega. So this is what you get. Divided by, the n factorial is there. So this is what you get. And now you can ask the question, so this is then a series which you have in the effective action in omega. It's a subseries of the full result. Focus on the subseries and ask yourself whether this is convergent. And to answer that question, and then I'll stop, you can now go, you have to massage these INs, take the S going to infinity limit, then these INs become something like n minus 1 factorial times d omega ds to the power n. So in this corner of moduli space, this sum collapses to 1 over n. to a 1 over n times v minus 1 v plus 1 times times d omega ds d omega dt d omega du to the power n. If you then further go to the perturbative point, which corresponded to working in the vicinity of equals 1.
2 gamma to the n.
Yes, there are certain factors which I have now missed in the rush of trying to finish. So there's also a 2 gamma here somewhere, I guess here. If you then analyze this in the vicinity of the perturbative point, v equals 1, which amounted to lambda, which was tantamount to a hat divided by x0 square small, then you find that this becomes, well, you find that you have a series here for a logarithm. Let me just give you the final result. So you find that this becomes approximated by a hat divided by x0 square to the power n. So this becomes that. This I'm going to call b. So 1 over b to the power n. So this becomes the log of a 1 minus a hat x0 square divided by b, provided you restrict yourself to values of the coupling in this disk. So this series gives you the log, provided that this coupling function is restricted to a disk with this as its radius. And so it would seem that the subseries we have obtained is convergent in a certain corner of the STU moduli space, provided the x0 coupling function is taken to be restricted to a perturbative region, bounded by the value of b, where b is this holomorphic quantity here. Now, of course, then, and these are the final remarks, the question is, what would happen if I would try to analytically extend the result to go outside? So this is this in the lambda. If this is the G top plane, then I'm working around in the vicinity of G top equals to zero in a disk with radius given by B, by modulus of B. And the question would then be, what happens if I decide to leave this region? I would have to do this by analytic continuation, and this is then perhaps where resurgence has something to say about these results. And I'll stop here.
So you opened with a very interesting question about the structure of the Michael entropy. What is the answer to that question?
I don't know.
So can you summarize, what is the punchline?
So the punchline,
yeah,
right.
What is the...
So let me put this in a broader context. If you look at BPS black holes in n equals to 8 and in n equals to 4, then something is known in that situation. Very little is known about n equals to 2. So this was an attempt to explore some of the considerations n equals to 2. But now coming back to n equals to 4 and n equals 8, let's start with n equals to 8. BPS black holes in n equals to 8. There was a microstate counting proposal for them.
Right.
And so if there's a microstate counting proposal for them, and the resulting entropy is to first approximation given by a Bessel function or a modified Bessel function with index, sorry, am I saying this right now? The degeneracy is to first approximation given by a Bessel function, a modified Bessel function of index 7/2. Now, as we heard from Gerald, Bessel functions with index 1/2 are not resurgent, from what I understood, in the sense that their asymptotic expansion truncates to a polynomial. But then to get the entropy, you would have to take the log. And then the story changes. But I don't know what the answer to your question is for n equals to 8. This is the only thing I can tell you. Now you could do the same thing for n equals to 4. In n equals to 4, you have to distinguish between large and small black holes. Large black holes are those that exist at the level of a 2 derivative gravity, and then they receive corrections. So the large ones have a degeneracy. So there are also formulae for degeneracies for these guys. The degeneracy here, the leading degeneracy is computed by, again, a modified Bessel function of index 23/2. It's again 1/2. All right.
As function of what argument? What is the argument?
Charges. Charges, Q. Charges. So Q is you have a large parameter, the charge, and it's organized in terms of large charges. So again, this would not be resurgent, from what I understood. But if you are interested in the entropy, you have to take the log of that. And then I have no idea what happens. But then there are small black holes. And small black holes these are dions, these are electrically or magnetically charged. These ones are captured by a modified Bessel with index 13.
The small black holes are the ones that don't exist at the level of the derivative gravity.
Exactly.
They have non-semi-classical objects, is that, or are
they? They only exist because of higher derivative terms, yes, in the action.
So where you're balancing a higher derivative against a lower derivative, so in that sense, they are something you would never know from the effective field theory point of view. Not really
semi-classical.
Is that what you're saying?
You would not, if you were to restrict yourself to two derivative level action, you would not see them, or rather they would correspond to naked singularities, which then, and the nakedness then gets dressed up
so
by.
If you see them, you need to complete the theory, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. So this would be resurgent. These ones do not seem to be resurgent, but if you take the log, then it's a different question. Now, this is known for n equals 4, for n equals 4, n equals 8. For n equals 2, very little is known.
And this is the technology to answer, but this
and so, so part of the work in n equals 2 has to do with trying to get to a state counting formula for black holes in a very specific model, such as the STU model, which is controlled by modular symmetry, where you can package your answers in terms of duality symmetries. First and second, you may then also try to see whether the result is resurgent in any way or not. But I cannot give you the answer to that.
I don't understand. If the function is not resurgent, is it possible that logarithm becomes resurgent? I think it sounds kind of strange, right? Could it be? Because log, you know how to expand the log, right? So because my impression would be that if it's not resurgent, then the answer should not depend whether it's log or not log, okay, because it is...
It's just terminology.
Sorry?
It's just terminology.
No, but I mean, there is definition of resurgence, right? So when you are saying that...
It can be resurgent, but it truncates, that's
sorry?
All. Resurgent, but it truncates, that's all.
I mean, that okay, you're saying that if the function is... doesn't have this factorial, okay, still you can call it resurgent, okay, but this is any function is okay, right? Then it's not specific, right?
Okay, but so perhaps one answer is to say that, well, okay, it's not resurgent maybe for large black holes in n equals 4 and n equals 8, but it could very well be resurgent for n equals 2. Mm-hmm. And since getting a hold on the completion, the non-perturbative completion of omega is very complicated. You may perhaps hope that by invoking resurgence you may get a step closer to that. But
I was confused about the various things. One thing is the mirror map in this model is trivial, isn't it?
Yeah.
The potential is cubic.
Yes, yes.
So it's not a generic, it is a highly ungeneric situation.
Yes, yes.
And it's suspicious of having secretly more supersymmetries or something.
Right,
so
right.
So you are in disguise discussing another n equal 4 model, not a really general.
It certainly is a very special model. However, an n equals to 4 model would not have any of these complications. So an n equals to 4 model written out in n equals to 2 language would just have that one. But now we have in the specific model all these guys, which have to be reproduced by a suitable state counting argument. So even though it's a very specific n equals to 2 model, I agree, it's still highly non-trivial. Okay. And the hope is that precisely because of being so special, but still much more complicated than n equals to 4, that eventually we may be able to get a glimpse at the state counting, okay? There's much more, yes.
The other question was, the statement is topological strings. I've heard in the past it has a potential.
Yes.
I cannot really put it anywhere.
Yes.
But so far, I mean, what you were saying there has nothing to do with what I would call this change of parameterization and so on. Can you explain this a little bit?
Right. So the topological free energies, if you write them in big moduli space in terms of homogeneous coordinates and not, sorry, the usual perturbative topological free energies, EFGs, which you compute, multiplied by powers of G top, by suitable powers of G top, if you write them in terms of homogeneous coordinates, constitute symplectic functions. And if you look at the sum of these perturbative free energies, that sum is a symplectic function, which is encoded in this Hessian potential.
But isn't this what does it have to do with strings? Isn't it just a parameterization, superparameter?
This Hessian potential I introduced satisfies. So the Hessian potential I introduced here was based on a holomorphic omega. The associated anomaly equation came out to be of the Shatashvili-Nekrasov type, with the term missing that is usually there in topological field theory, string theory. If you would have allowed for the omega to receive non-holomorphic corrections, and if you compute the associated Hessian potential, you would find that the Hessian potential precisely satisfies the topological, the holomorphic anomaly equation with all the usual terms in there. So I'm taking that, and I'm just calling that now the topological free energy, okay?
So that was some related question. Yeah. So using the holomorphic anomaly equation, when solving it, people say that there's an ambiguity of adding a holomorphic function. But somehow you don't seem to have that type of ambiguity. Is it constraint theory by SQRT? That's partly related to how you trade it for lambda tilde, effective.
Well, so in this construction, all these higher gravitational coupling functions turn out to be determined in terms of the parameter gamma, which could not be zero, and derivatives of the lowest one. And what we found is that this constitutes a consistent procedure for solving these various differential equations which we had.
Yeah, at some point, at least you were writing down the derivative with respect to S bar or something, because that's the holomorphic number equation. So.
Right, but. So then on the topological side, we did something else. We implemented the insight of U. Of Yao, Zhu, and Alim, which consisted in turning off these objects to get an ODE, which we solved exactly. Then we put these guys back into the game, and this result gets modified. But because of ST and U duality invariance,
so So that means that you can solve a twisting principle topological string. The all orders in but string coupling constant, or I mean, usually it's very hard to do that. So.
Usually it's very hard to do that. We certainly didn't find any obstruction in doing that.
Oh, really? I see.
In this particular model.
Uh-huh.
And
is that because you have the STU duality? Is that driving?
That itself sounds like quite a result. I mean, people try to solve a quintic, but only on up to genus 50 or so.
Yeah.
True, but because of the duality and the triality, which was crucial, we managed to determine these gravitational coupling functions to an arbitrary high order. We only did it to omega 5, but in principle, we don't see any obstruction going further. There are ambiguities coming in at earlier stages, but which we managed to fix by going to the higher coupling function, and we don't see any obstruction to this program were we to continue. On the topological string side, As I said, the game is a little bit different. The game is to start with this Alim Yu Zhu insight, which enables you to get an exact result for zero gravitational coupling functions, and then put them back into the game by turning them on again. But the turning on has to be such that turning these omegas back into the game translate into the appearance of this function h1, right? So we had omega 1 plus h0, which was determined by the Yao insight, and then this h1. But this h1 has to be such that when you switch off omega is 0. And it has to be duality invariant. So the natural thing then is to view this as a function of duality invariant combinations, and this is what we did. This is what we did by introducing these functions I tilde n, and then checking that we can actually solve the resulting differential equations. Now, of course, there's an infinite set of such equations. We have only solved a few ones. So far, we have not found any obstruction in whatever we have done. Yeah.
Just a comment. I think it is not quite correct to say that half integer Bessel is not resurgent.
Okay.
Because if you deform from half integer by epsilon amount, it would be resurgent.
Right.
So how does then, when you take the limit, it becomes non-resurgent? So it is not quite so. And what happens is that there is still, there are probably two exponentials there, and there is some asymptotics associated with it. But the residue of a pole or of a singularity goes to zero as you take that epsilon parameter, this deformation parameter, to zero. So in this sense, it is still asymptotic, you know. So there are similar, for example, quantum mechanical systems in which, for example, you get the energy to be zero, but in reality, it is zero times an asymptotic series. You can show this by deforming it epsilon away from the supersymmetric point. And sometimes this gives you, despite that it looks like it doesn't give you information about non-perturbative objects in the theory, when you do this tiny deformation, it gives you some information about the non-perturbative things in the theory.
Okay.